It's been 3 years since the Arab Spring started, but our guest today says from Egypt to Bahrain, the initial euphoria has given way to weariness, even despair. Some people say the Arab Spring has devolved into an Arab winter. Thanasi Kambanis is a journalist specializing in the Middle East and American foreign policy. He's based in Lebanon, where he's a fellow at the Century Foundation. Kambanis has written a recent article called What Sprouted in the Arab Spring. He says despite the pessimism that followed those first heady months, there are a few reasons for optimism in the Middle East.
The one spot where there really is still a glimmer of something positive, of something with real potential, is in the civil society and these really sort of small but dogged citizens groups that have emerged that propelled the uprising and then emerged in its immediate wake around the region. And they're still toiling, and they still are doing something that's got real potential to change the game here.
How far back do these civic groups go? I got the impression that they're really relatively recent.
So you can find civil society groups that were active 5 years ago or 10 years ago doing election monitoring, let's say, or organizing ad hoc around some very specific narrow political goal. But what emerged right around 2010, 2011, that was brand new is dynamic civic groups that were actually willing to frontally challenge power. And these groups are unique in a couple of ways. One is that they are completely legitimate, to use the locally popular word. In other words, they're not created by a Western nonprofit. They're not coming out of an incubator from, you know, NDI or IRI or one of these civil society pushes that comes from America or Europe. And they're, I won't say they're radical, but they're willing to really confront power. They're not tiptoeing around the repression of the regimes. For example, in Bahrain, they're the ones who are calling torture by the government torture, and documenting it and pushing it out there. And even when their leaders go in prison, they are regenerating their ranks and their leadership and pushing forward. They've been able to continue working under a really immense and brutal crackdown from central state authority. Some of their members get killed or get imprisoned or get tortured. Others have, you know, the usual tools of repression, you know, fraudulent, slanderous terrorism charges levied against them, media campaigns by the state media, and they keep going. And that's something that we've never seen before. In the past, when the state turns its might against civil society groups, they tend to wither or cower or simply limit their activity.
Talking with Thanasi Kambanis, who is in Lebanon, are there parallel organizations in the United States that might help my listeners understand what kind of group we're talking about specifically, or are these really unique to the Middle East?
There is not a healthy system of checks and balances or civil society in the Arab world like we have in the United States. So in the United States, we have, first of all, we have you know, Congress, courts, and the executive branch checking each other to some extent. We have political parties that exist independently of the government. We have media. We have universities. We have a whole bunch of things that we don't even notice what they do because they've been doing it since the founding of our republic. None of this exists in the Arab world as meaningful or independent forces. So there simply isn't a place where you would have a Noam Chomsky or his right-wing equivalent opining from a professor's perch and getting published and listened to. Those perches don't exist. Those institutions don't exist. There aren't libraries. There aren't newspapers or television stations that publish independently of government censors. So none of that infrastructure exists. So when you're looking at civil society, you're not looking for, say, you know, the Tea Party or the ACLU equivalent because there isn't the establishment in the first place for them to be operating independently of. You're looking for someone to do it all from scratch.
So essentially they are the checks and balances. Are these groups, let's go to Egypt, for example. I think most of our listeners have heard of the Muslim Brotherhood. We're not talking about the Muslim Brotherhood here.
No, we're talking about groups that are working under the banner of some of what I would call traditional liberal values: pluralism, freedom of speech, a commitment to truth, a commitment to political openness. So one group I talk about a lot because they're so small yet so influential is called Mosirin, and they're a video collective, and they just have a few dozen members. And since the beginning of the rebellion there, they've been going around with video cameras, documenting things that happen, and then putting together small edited films that counter the official propaganda or the official lies coming out of the government. And this, kind of incredibly, a few dozen people have managed again and again over the last 3 years to call out first the army and then the Muslim Brotherhood government of Mohamed Morsi, and now the new army government that succeeded him. They've been able to call out successive repressive governments in their lies and really change the narrative in a way that no kind of traditional journalist has been able to do before. The depressing thing about the current moment in the Arab revolt is the popularity of repression and fascism 3 years into the rebellion. And what I mean by that is in Egypt, where a coup has reinstated the army, we have a popular majority actually cheering for that. And so that's a really dark move back towards dictatorship by popular acclaim, and that is the real big mountain that these groups have to overcome. It's not just that they have to overcome a state that really doesn't want a single person taking the initiative or a single person thinking for themselves, but they have to overcome a public opinion that often sides with centralized authoritarian violent dictatorship. And that's the kind of attitude change that these groups are actively working to fight against. And I think, unfortunately, they have a really long way to go before they turn the opinions of their country, their fellow countrymen and women.
Should the U.S. play any role in helping these groups, or is it in the group's better interest for the U.S. to remain hands off?
The answer is the U.S. can't do much of anything to help them, and if it could, they'd best serve them by staying away for exactly the reasons you note. I mean, already a lot of these groups get tarred as American pawns, even though they have nothing to do with an American agenda or the U.S. It's just a way of slandering people. And the other thing is that the U.S. has much less of a role to play in these social transformations than we would hope. And the one lever it has is its political relations with the region. So, for example, it could help them in a global sense by cutting off aid to Egypt and condemning the latest military coup. But that would be indirect, right? That wouldn't actually contribute anything specific or tangible to groups like the No to Military Trials, who are trying to keep civilians out of kangaroo army courts.
Thanasi Kambanis writes for the Boston Globe. He's a fellow right now at Century Foundation based in Lebanon. His new book about the Egyptian Revolution and the aftermath of that will be published in January 2015. It's The Record with Ross Reynolds. I'm Marcy Silman.